Good morning. The first case for argument is appeal number 31073, Michael Gibson versus Greg Gibson et al. Jonathan Haber will be arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Gibson. And we have divided argument. Ed Evans will be arguing 10 minutes on behalf of the Gibson Partnership, and Zachary Peterson will be arguing on behalf of the Rone Appellees. Is that right? 5 and 10 minutes? Okay. And then Mr. Haber, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed at this time.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, counsel. I represent appellant Mike Gibson. Mike is appealing from the judgment of dismissal that was entered by the circuit court based upon alleged discovery violations made by his former trial counsel. He respectfully requests that the court vacate the judgment and remand for further proceedings based primarily on two different grounds. One, the judgment was not supported by the requisite findings of fact and conclusions of law, particularly the alleged violations under Rule 45B in the privilege. And two, even if there were discovery violations, procedural errors made by counsel does not warrant dismissing a party's case with prejudice. And to that end,
but your arguments are essentially what Mr. Sortland argued. Looks like you've just kind of rewarmed them up. There's HIPAA, privilege, standing, and in sort of this ends justifying the means sort of argument. So it looks very much like it did in front of Judge Means.
And Your Honor, particularly the issue with this case in that regard is an extraordinary sanction such as this, a dismissal of a case with prejudice, depriving a party of their day in court, requires, because it is so extraordinary, special findings by the court.
So I want to talk a little bit about the standard for dismissal under 15641B. We've talked about the standard as it relates to failure to prosecute under 41B. I don't know if we have as it relates to failure to comply with a rule. We've got the Rule 37 that talks about sanctions and including dismissal for discovery violations, which this looks a little bit like a discovery violation. What do you think is the, and maybe you're aware of a case, but I don't think there's a case out there where we've specifically talked under 41B, the appropriate standard for dismissal when we're talking about the failure to apply a rule of civil procedure.
I do think in some respects the law is murky on the area, especially as it relates to subpoenas, and as it relates to sanctions for discovery violations, but there is precedent. It's not a novel issue. The court has looked at discovery violations, and it has observed that when it relates to discovery, there needs to be a violation of a rule or court order.
So that's more Rule 37. You think that's the standard we ought to apply here under 41B?
I think that the standard is, as it relates, this is a discovery violation case, and I do think that that would be the standard in this case.
So, you don't think that Rule 45B was violated?
I do not, Your Honor. And I don't think the court issued any findings or made any determination as to what language in that statute was violated.
Yeah, what do you think? Why do you think it's compliant? And let me put it to you this way. As I see it, you're making the same exact argument that Mr. Sortland made. And in your view, it seems as though the court is on the clock of the issuing party, and the court must rule promptly or in any event before the time for compliance established in the subpoena. I don't think Rule 45B says that. The rule says the court, upon motion made promptly and in any event before the time specified for compliance. That's when the motion has to be made. I don't think that the text says that the court has to rule before compliance. That would really put the court on the clock. Do you disagree?
Your Honor, I would submit that the rule is murky at best in terms of exactly.
You know, we read stuff all the time. We have rules for how we do it. We look at plain and unambiguous text. What's murky? Is murky ambiguous? Is this, because can we read this for its plain text or not? Because if the violation of 15.6 is at the heart of this Rule 41B determination, and probably is, findings or not, can we see and can we evaluate the strength of your argument that 45B was, you were fully compliant with it, or Mr. Sortland was?
And thank you, Your Honor, for that. Your Honor, I think there is an opportunity for the court to look at that and make a determination of what it does require.
How do you read that text? That's my question.
The way I read it on the plain language would be that the moving party needs to promptly make a motion.
Not the court. The court doesn't have to rule. I'm putting words in your mouth, but is that right or is that wrong?
Candidly, Your Honor, the statute says the court may make a determination. It doesn't indicate what a party must do in terms of the subpoenaing party.
And it seems to contemplate that the court will make a determination, right? And that, yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that it's not available to a party, an issuing party, to unilaterally preempt the court in its role as a judicial supervisor for the subpoena process. Agree with that?
And Your Honor, I would submit as to a step in the middle there of what a party must do when a party makes a motion to quash but doesn't set it for hearing. Then what? What happens? And it's
so your argument would be in that instance then that the issuing party can essentially say, well, I get to decide. I get to decide, and I can go ahead and I can just not worry about that objection 2 weeks later, and I can just go ahead and do it. That has to be your argument. Before we get to the seriousness of the offense, before we get to whether this is a right response as a discretionary matter, I think we have to resolve whether we have a violation of this chapter or not.
And Your Honor, a tool that a objecting party would have would be to seek a temporary stay from the court pending any determination. And what could be done and what wasn't done was any of the appellees going to the court and saying, we have this pending motion. Can we stay this until we've had this heard? We'll notice for hearing.
Fair enough. They could have done that. If that doesn't happen, then what authority can you point me to or point the court to that says the issuing party gets to preemptively say, forget it. I'm going to go ahead and get this information anyway. I'm not telling anybody about this objection. I'm just going to go ahead and do what I want to do.
In this instance, the subpoena was served, motion to quash was filed and not noticed, and then the hospital turned over the documents.
I understand that. But my question is, what authority do you have that says that the issuing party can just say 2 weeks later, heck with it. There's no hearing. I'm going to go ahead and go get that information. Hospital or clinic's ready to give it to me. I'm just going to go do it. I'm not telling anybody.
In this case, former counsel did share the records with opposing counsel. And so the question then, and I guess where the law is murky, in my view, is what happens when a responding party, non-party, the hospital in this instance, turns over the records? What then must happen? In this instance, the records were turned over. They were communicated to opposing counsel and said, here are the records. We intend to file the second amended complaint.
Well, let me point you to what I think is your better argument. I mean, the court found bad faith violation of the rules. Found that on the record at the hearing. That looks like it's supported by the record in my view. So My question to you is why did the court abuse its discretion in dismissing this appeal? Assuming, again, I you may not be there, but assuming we find a bad faith violation of Rule 45, how'd the court abuse its discretion in dismissing the case?
On multiple grounds, Your Honor, we would submit. And one would be, first of all, not issuing sufficient findings of fact, conclusions of law as to specifically what language was violated, what statute was violated, but two, weighing the five factors. In terms of in issuing a dismissal, it's one thing to consider sanctions for a violation, and it's another thing to consider the most extraordinary sanction possible, which is dismissal with prejudice of a lawsuit and depriving someone of their day in court. In this court, in Dudley versus Huizenga, has set forth the five factors that are required to weigh, and those factors were not weighed in determining whether or not dismissal with prejudice was appropriate in this case.
Should the court consider whether Mr. Soverland or the representatives or his attorneys are accepting responsibility for violation? Does that factor in at all?
Your Honor, it could. I don't think it would be a strong factor in terms of dismissing with prejudice. Because
why not? The court really felt, and the court was very clear on this point, whether you think the findings were otherwise okay or not, but the court was really clear. Said, look, I think you're going to do it again. And you could do it again. And, of course, Mr. Soverland's not there now, but you are. And if you win here today, all the same arguments that Mr. Soverland made are in your brief. And so Judge Means' finding about whether you're getting it seems to resonate still.
Your Honor, that's a point well taken. I think one would be this court has remarked that dismissal is loathed, is reluctant to dismiss a case with prejudice when there's an errant attorney. And here, that's why in the five factors is a requirement or a factor of whether or not the party was warned. In this instance, the party was not warned. And we're talking about Mike Gibson. Mike Gibson is not warned in terms of what the violations were and what the outcome could be if it occurred again. And on appeal, while appellant has maintained there's no violation of any rule, we certainly would respect the court's determination, and we certainly would respect this court's determination on whether or not a violation occurred in providing clarity on that specific issue.
So if we uphold the trial court's finding of bad faith, that's factor one. Adversary prejudice, you've got these arguably confidential, privileged records out there. You can argue there's prejudice. Third factor, deterrence. Court talked a lot about that. I think you're going to do this again if I don't dismiss this case. So then you're kind of down to whether the party was warned and less drastic sanction.
And Your Honor, on the less drastic sanction on that issue, one of the sanctions requested was that prior counsel be removed from the case, and that has happened. They have prior counsel has withdrawn from the case, and so one of the sanctions that appellees actually deemed appropriate as a sanction has occurred, and we would submit that if lesser sanctions were required in this or appropriate in this, that would be a lesser sanction that has already occurred. But I want to address before my time runs out that this case involves medical records. It's a sensitive subject, but the question is whether or not those records were privileged. And this is a case where my client, Mike Gibson, was seeking the medical records of his mother, Dolores Gibson, based on undue influence claims, which often traditionally relate to medical condition.
Aren't you buying into Mr. Soverland's claims when you make that argument? That is, I messed up, I violated the rules, but hey, if a judge would have had the opportunity to rule on this, if I would not have preempted the judge would have allowed me to have those records. That's not how it's supposed to work, is it?
Your Honor, I do think it weighs in because I think what finding ought to have been made was were those records privileged? And because prejudice is one of the factors, whether an adversary was prejudiced.
What if one way to read the record could be they're privileged until someone says the privilege is waived? Because medical records generally are privileged, just in the main. So what's so wrong about that?
Your Honor, we have submitted that in this instance, the medical records were waived, they were authorized to be released, and were released.
But again, that would only be an ends justifying the means argument. That would not be, I don't even know that that issue substantively is teed up.
And Your Honor, I guess the final point before my time runs out here, the point I would make is, again, while at the lower court level, former counsel perhaps may have not indicated that they would comply with the rules, I can assure you that Mike Gibson, going forward, would respect any determination by the court and clarity on any kind of rules regarding subpoenas or compliance with the rules. He's been deprived of an opportunity to understand that, to comply with it, be warned of it.
Thank you, Mr. Haber. Mr. Evans, you're going to go first.
May it please the court, counsel, the trial court dismissed the plaintiff's case for plaintiff's repeated egregious, blatant, bad faith, and willful abuse of discovery in wrongfully obtaining the medical records over the repeated objections of both Gibson Family Limited Partnership and non-party Dolores Gibson. There was an objection raised on her behalf during Dr. Hendrick's deposition, and went ahead and obtained all of these records without permission, over objections, and without an appropriate court order. And I think it's very, the court has identified the issue here. They simply say, well, we were entitled to them, but why not give the court a chance to rule? That's the court's rule, not their role. And they say, well, we don't have to go get a court order. We know we're right. Think of that. Such arrogance and abuse. The plaintiff first attempted to obtain Dolores' medical records without her permission, without a court order, in May of 2024, when he issued the subpoena ducis tecum to various third parties. He didn't give notice of the depositions being served, didn't file the subpoenas when they were served, so they're just out there with us not knowing about them. How do we find out about them? When the sheriff files the return of service that the subpoenas have been served, long after they'd been served. No doubt trying to obtain, they were trying to obtain these personal, financial, and medical records without anybody's knowledge and without giving
notice. Mr. Evans, let's assume we uphold the finding of bad faith, finding of violation of Rule 45. Court found both of those things. Let's assume we uphold that.
Okay.
Mr. Haber, as it relates to the remedy, wants to apply that five-factor sanction test from Rule 37 that we applied in Dudley. You think that's the right test?
That's one of the tests, but I think this court can also, or the trial court could also, in its discretion, dismiss for just abuse of the process and the rules. And not apply Rule 37.
So, I understand that. So, and maybe when you have a bad faith finding, maybe it's over. You know, I don't know. But my concern is, we write this case and we say, yeah, bad faith, and pretty soon you get motions all the time, courts or attorneys saying, let's dismiss under Rule 41B. They didn't comply with the rule here. Don't we need some sort of standard to tell trial courts this is when it's appropriate to dismiss or not dismiss the case? Because that's a big deal. I mean, we're I understand you may not think of much of a lawsuit, but again, this is dismissing a case before anyone's ever heard of a fact in this case.
No, I agree. A severe standard, it should be applied, and I think it is historically by the courts. Courts aren't dismissing cases for simple violation of discovery rules. But when you have bad faith, willful, repeated, egregious conduct, I don't know what more you could have to warrant dismissal of a claim.
So let me ask you this. Do you think you need a court order? You know, typically under Rule 37, you don't answer discovery or you have some discovery violation. Court enters a motion to compel, you still don't comply. Typically, that's where you get to dismissal. Do you think you need a court order to dismiss it? So if the court had said, hey, you violated Rule 45, I think you did it in bad faith, they get another chance after that or not?
I don't think, with the bad faith finding and the willfulness, I don't think you need to give plaintiff another chance, another bite at the apple, or give them the discretion that you might, a party that through mistake, oversight, inadvertence, or whatever, committed a discovery abuse.
So in this case, the court seemed to put a lot of emphasis on bad actions by prior counsel who's no longer in the case and said, hey, I think you're going to just keep doing this. You know, you're walking in here, you know, pretty bold today and having, in the court's view, violating the rules in bad faith. And the court kept saying, I think you're going to do this again if I don't. So isn't a less drastic remedy? Hey, you're pro hoc vice. I mean, this guy's not licensed in South Dakota. You're gone. Does that take care of the issue? Is that a less drastic remedy that should have been considered by the court in this case?
I don't know whether it was considered or not by her, but basically counsel told the court that there was no other alternatives, that he didn't do anything wrong, and even if he did, the ends justified the means, and wasn't looking for another appropriate remedy. He never offered that as a remedy, he never suggested it as a remedy, nor did he suggest anything else other than, well, gee whiz, Judge, we're entitled to those records, we're keeping them, we aren't returning them, we aren't filing them under seal with the court, we aren't going to let the court look at them to decide whether or not we're entitled to any of them. We're keeping all of them. They still have them to this day. We're incorporating them into an amended complaint and filing it for the public to see. And that was his answer to the situation. No proposed alternative remedy or a lesser remedy. And here, you know, I understand that dismissing a case for counsel's abuse of the process and willful bad faith is drastic. It deprives the client of his day in court. But I mean, if you think about it, cases get dismissed for failure to prosecute. Cases get dismissed. I can sign settlement agreements on behalf of my client. We sign admissions. We settle cases. We dismiss cases. Second, I find it very interesting that at no time has the plaintiff, Michael Gibson, ever signed an affidavit stating this was all done without his knowledge and that he personally objects to what happened. He never signed an affidavit, nor did Mr. Sortland ever prepare any evidence to contest anything that was said by the hospital, that they were affirmatively misled and told that the parties were working together and that there was no objection. I mean, to me, that is the most blatant abuse of the process, to use the court's name on a subpoena to obtain these records and to tell them, intentionally lie and say nobody has any objection to these. If that doesn't warrant dismissal, and again, plaintiff could sign an affidavit saying this didn't happen. Counsel's office could sign an affidavit saying we didn't represent that to the hospital. None of that's there. Nothing other than we didn't do anything wrong and we were entitled to the records in any event. So based upon that, I think that the finding of bad faith warrants the dismissal. And I do think, and this is in Mr. Moorhead's brief, that the Michael Gibson's prior conduct, him standing here now with his present counsel saying this will not happen again through his present counsel, here's a person that at a previous trial committed perjury, admitted stealing over $500,000 from this family partnership and his mother, and got reported by the trial court to the state's attorney and the attorney general's office. I do think that type of conduct can be considered as to whether to give him some benefit of the doubt. So for all of those reasons, Your Honor, the judgment of dismissal should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Mr. Peterson, you can proceed with argument.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent the Ronayn defendants, and we join the arguments made by Gibson Family Limited Partnership here today, supporting affirmance of the judgment of dismissal. My argument will be limited to an alternative argument related to the issue that Ronayn and Greg and Joan Gibson noticed for review. Specifically, the issue is whether a plausible claim for breach of fiduciary duty is stated under the circumstances of this case, where the person alleged to owe the fiduciary duty is Greg Gibson, who is a limited partner in the Gibson Family Limited Partnership. We contend that the answer is no. And the first reason for that and the starting point is that there is no statutory authority in South Dakota for limited partners owing fiduciary duties. And Michael Gibson does not argue otherwise. We know that the general partner in a limited partnership owes a fiduciary duty to limited partners. However, there is no like provision as it relates to a fiduciary duty between limited partners like Greg and Michael Gibson. And that makes sense because if you look at the reasoning of the Wyoming Supreme Court in the Wallop Canyon case, you know, they discuss how limited partnerships are intended to be a different entity and they serve a different purpose. And if you impose the same duties on limited partners as general partners, that kind of defeats the purpose of the entity. Similarly, there is no language within the Gibson Family Limited Partnership Agreement which would create a fiduciary duty. Once again, Michael Gibson does not argue otherwise. As this court recognized in the prior Gibson decision, as limited partners, Michael and Greg have no significant duties. And finally, there is no prior case law from this court taking this issue on. Again, Michael Gibson doesn't argue otherwise.
So do you think that the sole source of a fiduciary duty would come from statute? In other words, we couldn't look and apply common law tests, which we've noted in several cases here, to determine whether a fiduciary duty exists. Under a theory, forgive me, I'm so sorry, but under our theory, essentially, that though there may not be fiduciary duties as established, the actions or the conduct of one limited partner could engage, at least for purposes of 12b-5 analysis, engage those elements and those criteria for the existence of a fiduciary duty, which might come into existence even though it might not have already otherwise existed based upon the conduct of that limited partner.
I think under the facts as pled, which the amended complaint, we take it as true here, I don't think you can get there on this case. And the reason I say that is because, you know, there is no allegation that Michael reposed faith, confidence, and trust in Greg. In fact, I think the opposite is what you would gather from the amended complaint. We also know they were equal limited partners, and we also know that there's an allegation in the amended complaint that Dolores remained the general partner throughout all the operative events in the complaint, and in fact was the general partner at the time of the filing of the lawsuit. So I really don't think you have a plausible claim, even if you go to the common law test, which is what I think they've argued now in their reply brief. But I mean, below, it was this idea that, well, Greg has stepped into the shoes of the general partner. Well, none of the things that are required for that to happen happened in this case. They're not alleged. In fact, it's alleged Dolores remained the general partner. And if, you know, there's no allegation of the statutory factors relating to, or the events that caused a general partner to cease in their role. None of that is alleged. The limited partnership agreement specifies things that happen when a limited or a general partner ceases to be general partner. None of that is alleged. And so to treat Greg as the general partner instead of a limited partner, you've got to ignore the statutes, the agreement, and their own pleading. So that's why I view this as an implausible claim in this case under any test that you run it under.
So, Mr. Peterson, I want to ask you, this is maybe just kind of a practical question I'm thinking about. If we uphold the dismissal under 41B, obviously it's over. We don't even address the issue. But if we don't and send that issue back, you've still got three other causes of action in this case that there was no dismissal on, correct, that you're going to have to defend?
I see my time has expired, my answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not as to my clients. We are named only in counts 2 and 3.
Okay. So you're out.
Correct.
If those two claims are dismissed.
That's our position, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Haber.
Mr. Haber, when the Chief Justice was talking to Mr. Evans about Mr. Shortland being gone, and you and I talked about that a little bit as well. And you said, well, you know, we'll respect the rulings of the court or this court or the other court or some court. The difficulty, it seems like to me, is one of kind of a mixed message. On one hand, you're saying, in sort of repeating the refrain of the arguments that Mr. Shortland made, as if to say, he was completely right on the law. It was all right. But then you say, I guess that's not going to happen again. Those are in tension to me.
Your Honor, I want to draw a distinction between advocating for the position of my client and the law and seeking clarity on what the law is, and a case where there was not sufficient findings or conclusions to understand what the determination was, what specifically was violated, and what wasn't. And so we don't have that clarity due to the lack of findings and conclusions. So on appeal, we maintain that no violation occurred. However, understanding that this court, de novo, could determine whether or not a violation occurred. And if so, and if that happens, certainly will, and obviously respect that decision going forward.
Let me ask you, do you believe a violation occurred?
Your Honor, would I have done things differently?
No. This is important to me. It seems to me that Judge Means indicated that the remedy she chose was because there was absolutely no contrition, no acknowledgement that something was violated. And she thought, whether right or wrong, that the only way to resolve that is to dismiss the case. And as I'm listening to you right now, I'm getting the opinion that you don't think anything was wrong. Do you think the Rule 45 was violated?
Your Honor, my answer is a tricky answer on that, only insofar as to what the law requires a party in the instance of my client to do in a situation like this.
Is that a yes or no?
Your Honor, I think that that the statute's unclear, but yes, if to the extent the court must rule beforehand, then yes, the violation would have occurred in that instance. We have maintained in the alternative that that's not what's required under the rule. But again, it's a situation where I would say in practice, this is a situation as far as subpoenas and what to do in this situation that happens and comes up, and I think there's a lack of clarity on what the parties would do.
There's an objection to a subpoena, no hearing is set. What prevents the requesting party to simply say, we want a hearing?
Right, certainly. Mr. Sortland could have asked that a hearing be set. I would suggest that the onus would be on the moving party to set that hearing that made the motion, or make an effort to set the hearing, or seek a temporary stay until such decision was made. But
Mr. Evans notes that you are asking for a less severe remedy than dismissal, but then says, essentially mirroring the comments earlier, that Mr. Sortland's approach was, I didn't do anything wrong, didn't offer any alternative, didn't suggest a less restrictive alternative besides dismissal. Your response?
Your Honor, I think that the court under the five factors is required to consider a lesser sanction. I think the burden on that is the court to weigh that and not for...
But did Mr. Sorland propose anything less restrictive, as you've discussed?
I believe in the motion for reconsideration, Your Honor, is when that would have been proposed at that time. Not at the hearing, it was maintained that simply that no violation occurred and that the court is to weigh the five factors. And so to that end, I don't believe it's on my client's responsibility to propose a lesser sanction. But with that said, a lesser sanction was proposed.
It's not your client's responsibility to propose a lesser sanction?
Well, no, Your Honor, my apologies on that. It is the responsibility of the court to weigh the five factors on whether or not a lesser sanction. And I think the Supreme Court has observed that when considering dismissal, because it is so extraordinary.
But how do we know the court didn't weigh those lesser factors because nothing was proposed to the court?
And I think, Your Honor, may I answer? I've run out of time.
Go ahead.
Without sufficient findings of fact and conclusions of law, we don't know entirely what was considered or what findings, what conclusions, what the court weighed.
So the court was supposed to say, I make a finding that I considered the things that they didn't propose.
Your Honor, I think the court in this instance was supposed to weigh the five factors, including whether or not less drastic sanctions can be imposed before dismissal is one of the five factors. And I do think the court was required due to that five-factor test to weigh that factor, whether or not a less drastic sanction than dismissal is prejudice.
Not clear that even applies in Rule 45 context. I'm sorry, I know we're out of time. Forgive me.
You have anything else, Justice Alito?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, counsel, for your arguments. I should note Sandra Moorhead is here separately representing Greg and Joan Gibson, submitted a brief but didn't argue this morning. With that, the case is fully submitted. We'll be in recess.